Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments today. First, in a few minutes, Philip Shelley, a student in the University of Southern Maine, about the university's firing of tenured faculty. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Cesar Ayala and Rafael Bernabe about Puerto Rico's economic crisis. Until recently, tenured faculty enjoyed great job security, but lately, universities have been challenging that. Last week, the University of Maine system announced plans to fire about 15 tenured faculty at their University of Southern Maine campus in Portland. While it might be easy to look down on tenured faculty as ivory tower elitists, what this is about is very clear, yet another attack on the living standards of American workers, and at the same time, an attack on critical intellectual endeavor. Fortunately, there's some fight back. Here's Philip Shelley, a student at USM, to tell us more. Tell us a little about yourself. You're a student at the University of Southern Maine?
I am. I'm a non-traditional English major at the University of Southern Maine. I came to Maine about 4 years ago. I'm originally a New Yorker. I'm 50 years old, so this was a midlife career change for me. I hope to be a high school English teacher someday.
And what drew you to Maine?
I wanted to get out from under the Boston, New York, Washington umbrella. Maine seemed just far enough. I'd be coming here in the summers. It's quite beautiful.
The University of Southern Maine is part of a larger University of Maine system, right?
Correct. There are seven campuses. Maine is very protective of, it's a, you know, in a very poor and sparsely populated state. It is kind of interesting how protective they are of having local institutions of higher education.
Now, the university is not in any particular financial crisis, but they've taken the drastic move of laying off tenured faculty. What's going on there?
Well, we don't know if there's a financial crisis or not. Susan Feiner, who's an economist and a professor at the university, has used the Freedom of Information Act to get a lot of financial information. And as a public information, as a public university, all that financial information is findable. And so a lot of us refute the idea of a crisis at all. We think it's a manufactured crisis. Personally, I think it's a policy crisis. It's a political hatchet job. This is part of a much wider attack on public education in this country and around the world.
Yeah, I want to put that into context in a minute, but let's talk a bit about these layoffs. So there are, what, 10 faculty members at USM that were targeted?
I believe the original number was 15, and I believe that 12 of them did actually get notice of termination.
And I know one philosophy professor, Jason Reed, was spared because somebody decided to retire to protect him. But who else can you characterize the people who've been targeted for layoff?
Well, the layoffs are done according to retrenchment. So according to the party line, it is last tenured, first out. So that's what they're saying. But in effect, what we've seen is that those targeted are in the humanities, in the liberal arts. They are in programs that are targeted for cutting or otherwise imperiled, such as theater or art or music, and that they are disproportionately targeted at women, people of color, and members of the LGBT community.
And I suppose you could say that those are the folks who are last hired, usually, and therefore first fired, but it does look like a suspicious pattern.
Yeah, you certainly could say that. It simply reflects that they've had a harder time finding positions at the university. One of the most pernicious things that you touched upon is the way this pits younger faculty, who are the life's blood of the university, and older faculty, who represent the continuity and history of the institution. Right. So it creates this false moral dichotomy where professors who are eligible for retirement have to really say, oh, my God, should I step aside for my younger colleague, which is totally unfair to the older professors. And of course, eliminating younger professors eliminates the professors who have the energy, who in many cases relate best to the students and are willing to build programs and do a lot of the community building stuff that older professors and we need older professors too, but that they're not able to do so much anymore.
Yeah, you would think that the ideal would be some balance of older and younger so that you get the fresh blood and life of the younger along with the experience and wisdom of the older. But it doesn't seem like administrations are thinking in those ways.
No, I think, I'm not sure how much you want to get into the broader thing, but I think it's just a pattern of harassment, right? I think they're trying to whack as many as they can. They're going to get some, they're going to lose some, and they'll continue to harass the faculty until there's none left, and they'll just use whatever tools they have at their disposal. So this is just one little skirmish in a much larger war.
And what about the other campuses in the University of Maine system? What do you hear from them?
In terms of student solidarity, the response has been great. There's a demonstration at UMaine Orono, I believe today. They realize that what's happening at USM is sort of a staging ground, a sort of a test case. But this is coming to a public university near everyone. They have a vision of a sort of Hunger Games style vision of the UMaine system, where Orono, which is the main campus, is sort of the crown jewel. And if you want a liberal arts education, perhaps you will be able to still get it there. But then each of the little satellite universities, of which USM is considered one, although USM is in the most populous city in the most populous region of the state and has over 6,000 full-time students, but we're considered a satellite. And I think they want each campus to produce one specific type of product.
And what do you suppose they have in mind for USM?
They're pretty blatant about it. USM is in Portland, and being the most populous city in Maine, it is the seat of Maine's business community and Maine's not particularly significant technology sector and our banking and our law. And so I think they want to manufacture business students. They've talked a lot about what they call a metropolitan university, which seems to be a euphemism for being very responsive to business interests, a lot of internships, and again, another nonsense term, active learning. So getting students out there and sort of providing slave labor to the business community and turning out made-to-order, tailor-made automatons.
A friend of mine in hearing of this mentioned the fact that the governor of Maine seems barely fit to hold office. Now, I really know nothing about the governor of Maine, but what can you say about him and the government he runs?
Well, I'm not a big fan of the governor. The governor, you know, he is a Tea Party governor. He is an extreme right-wing lunatic, and he's been very, very harmful to the state of Maine, which is... It's not the most liberal state in the world, but it's a pretty old-fashioned sort of rock-ribbed Republican type of state. So it's a sensible place, and I think it's crazy. He was elected with 37% of the vote because there was a third-party candidate here who unfortunately is running again. But LePage has been outspoken, extremely outspoken in his support for education reform. He's modeled his attack on public education in Maine on Jeb Bush, on Arne Duncan's programs. He held a conference, I think about a year ago, in March of 2013, an education conference where he invited lobbyists from the reform movement and all those charter school people here. And he's definitely promoting privatization and corporatization of public education in Maine.
So it sounds like the vision of that would be from kindergarten to beyond, an educational system that was geared towards delivering drones for corporate America, or at least corporate Maine.
That's a big part of it. It would be sort of crushing critical thinking and creativity. The other part of it is just blatant profit. There's a lot of profit to be made in delivering education through technology. There's Pearson is the largest education company in the world and the largest publishing company in the world. And Pearson is committed to online education. They have so many foundations and lobbying groups now They're buying up every online education company they can get their hands on. So there's a lot of money in delivering education through online channels. The board of trustees of the UMaine system consists of businessmen and bankers, all of whom have this vision of education as a product that they can deliver through technological channels. And of course, when you do that, you don't need professional teachers. You deprofessionalize the entire teaching profession. You can get insecure adjuncts. You can even get $10 an hour labor. You can even offshore it eventually.
I'm speaking with Philip Shelley, a student at the University of Southern Maine.
And of course, for people who don't know the conventions of academia, tenured faculty were thought, except in the most extreme cases of financial exigency or wrongdoing, to have a lifetime job. And now this is an attack on that model, right?
Absolutely. You know, tenure is necessary in order to preserve academic freedom, in order to preserve freedom to investigate any intellectual path. And, you know, frankly, the powers that be can't stand that. They've had it in. They have a deep antipathy and antagonism towards professors because professors do have freedom, because they do have job security, and they're one of the few institutions left in America that represent any values other than purely monetary profit values and that have any sort of respect and social standing. They still have a voice. You know, they can still write editorials in the newspapers. Some people still, you know, actually respect professors.
So the attack on tenured faculty is an escalation of this war, which it's a war on two fronts, really. I mean, it's an economic war. They want to cut the expenditures on higher ed. At the same time, they want to launch intellectual attack on independent thought. I mean, it's from the point of view of the governor and the business people on the board, this is a multiply excellent war from their point of view. How do you see this in the context of what's going on elsewhere outside Maine?
Maine's just in the forefront because we happen to be a poor kind of out-of-the-way state where they can try out a lot of things. But this is part of a concerted and predatory and merciless attack on public education, as you said. I mentioned Pearson earlier. I mentioned the governor modeling his education conference on Jeb Bush's education conference. I've heard people talk about Arnie Duncan on your show. There's the Walton Foundation. There's the Gates Foundation. There's so many people aligned here trying to make this happen. Part of it is that public education money is one of the last large pools of public money in this country that hasn't been privatized. And so they're slobbering. They want every penny of it. They want to gut education, and they want to take all that money.
And now you alluded to this earlier with the divisions between older faculty and younger faculty, but then you also have divisions between tenured people and adjuncts. Adjuncts have no security at all, extremely poorly paid, highly exploited labor. And tenure, from the point of view, if you're slaving away for teaching a course for a few thousand bucks, you might look at the tenured faculty as royalty. Do you see any signs of tension or any signs of solidarity developing between what might be materially opposed forces?
The good news is, I think, at least at USM, people are pulling together in a rather moving and inspiring way. You know, morale is low, tensions are high, and yet there's an incredible sense of hope and solidarity. We may lose this fight. We may win it. It may be a draw. This is an ongoing thing. This isn't just stop here. I think education is something that we're going to have to start fighting for the rest of our lives. You know, this is no longer something we're just going to get. So I think this battle goes on, and I think people are really coming through in surprising and gratifying ways. They're putting their values, they're putting their academic theories, their belief systems to the test. And pretty much everybody is putting their money where their mouth is now, putting their actions behind their beliefs in a really cool way.
Did these firings come out of the blue, or were people suspicious that they might be in the offing?
Oh, I think we've been expecting this for years, at least 2 years, that this has been definitely on the horizon. But I think even those of us, like myself, who tend to be pessimistic and have absolutely no faith in the university administration or in LePage's government to support a public liberal arts education, are surprised at the ruthless, devastating swiftness. I think most professors believed that, well, they're not replacing retired faculty. They're not hiring new tenure track faculty. They're going to harass us and give us a hard time, but they'll let it die a slow death. So I think that they figured traditional academia would be allowed to sort of fade out. I don't think anyone really realized how actively and relentlessly they would just continue attacking. I don't think anyone thought tenured professors would be whacked by the dozen like this. Retrenchment is definitely a way, which I think this is a test case. Retrenchment is definitely a sort of digging deep into union contracts and emergency and exigent situations and looking for loopholes that will allow them to actively get rid of tenured faculty way, way before they would otherwise retire or fade away.
And do you have any sense of whether this came from the governor's office or the university administration dreamt it up all by themselves?
Wow, I don't know the answer to that, although LePage does appoint the Board of Trustees to the UMaine system. That is like a federal appointment, like where he names the guy, and then I think the legislature has to approve it. I think there's 16 people on the board. Right now there's one vacancy, so there's 15, and I'm not 100% sure, but I believe LePage appointed 8 of them.
And I presume, as in most states, legislatures have been cutting funding to state universities. I assume Maine is no exception?
Absolutely, yeah.
And where do you see this going? I mean, is this a fait accompli, or is there any possibility that actions by students and faculty could reverse the decision?
Again, I'm a pessimistic person, and it's incredible if you read interviews with USM President Theodore Calico from 2 years ago when she first was appointed to her position. She talks quite blatantly and quite plainly about more technology, more online classes. They talk about education as if it were like McDonald's, right? Go to class when you want. Go to school in your pajamas online. Set your own schedule. Make more money. As if it were this product where the values of speed, ease, and convenience applied, where those values are actually, they run counter to traditional academic values. So she's been very clear about her goals. The administration is very clear about the kind of goals they wanted to achieve. And they bring the university through this whole direction package process where we're supposed to be searching together with shared governance of the students, the faculty, and the administration. But it's a predetermined process in a way, because we've been through this for 2 years, and lo and behold, where we end up is exactly where President Calico suggested, where she was talking about us ending up 2 years ago. But I think that they sort of thought, we'll just do what we want to do, and we'll weather a little bit of protest, but nobody really cares. It's a pretty apathetic commuter school, and at the end of the day, you know, we'll just get back to business. So I'm not sure, but I think, to answer your question, perhaps they're getting a little more than they bargained for this weekend. I think that there's some really talented community organizers among the student body. There's some really savvy communicators. Some very sharp people, Jules Purnell, Megan LaSala, Caroline O'Connor. These are all fellow students of mine, and these are people half my age too, because I'm a middle-aged man. I've just been so impressed with their organizational savvy, their ability to not just demonstrate or be activists, but to set a targeted, realistic agenda. We're attacking this on many levels. The legislature, the media has been good so far to us. And I think the administration's forced to notice because so much of this is playing out in public. So maybe it will, at least in the short term, have some salutary effect. I hope so.
That's Philip Shelley, a student at the University of Southern Maine, on the university's firing of tenured faculty. To follow the fight and to find addresses to write letters of complaint to, search the hashtag USMFuture, USMFuture, on Facebook or Twitter. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Rotary by Eleanor Lean and Apparat. Next up are two guests to talk about the economic difficulties of Puerto Rico, which are nothing new, but nonetheless got some attention because it became bond market news. The island, which has been in recession since 2006, is under severe fiscal pressure and got its credit rating downgraded to junk in advance of a $3.5 billion bond offering earlier this month. That brings Puerto Rico's total indebtedness to $70 billion, which is about 70% of the island's GDP. That's high, but not screamingly so, yet. But investors are worried that Puerto Rico is the next Detroit. That probably means some sort of austerity program, also like Detroit. Here to put the current mess into context are Cesar Ayala and Rafael Bernabe, authors of Puerto Rico in the American Century, published in 2009 by the University of North Carolina Press. Ayala is a professor of sociology at UCLA, and Bernabe is a professor of literature at the University of Puerto Rico. Bernabe speaks first. Unusually, Puerto Rico has attracted the attention of the financial markets the last couple of months, but these economic troubles that necessitated a large bond sale and earned a junk bond rating from the rating agencies have a long, long history. Let's just start by saying, what is the state of the Puerto Rican economy now? It's been in recession for years now, right?
Yes, the economy of Puerto Rico has been in recession for about 8 years, officially speaking. That is, it hasn't grown for the past 8 years. And this is a manifestation of the failure of the basic economic policy of the government of Puerto Rico that has been in operation for decades. It's an economic policy, the axis of which is the attraction of U.S. corporations to carry out operations in Puerto Rico. And the main means for attracting these corporations to Puerto Rico is the policy of tax exemption, that is the non-collection of taxes from these companies that operate in Puerto Rico. The problem with this is that this incentive has been failing in terms of generating investment in Puerto Rico. So the economy is not growing, employment is not growing, the earnings of the governments are not growing, plus the policy of tax exemption deprives the government of an important source of income. Therefore, you have the two elements of the present crisis, which is that the government is in crisis, the finances of the government are in crisis, and the economy is in crisis too. So these two elements are combined to create a very difficult situation economic-wise in Puerto Rico.
I would like to add that, there's two elements here. One of them is the underlying structural problem of an economy that is basically an enclave in the sense that it relies on foreign direct investment, and it has done so for a century now. with very little local capital formation. That's on the one hand. But on the other hand, the principal incentive that used to attract U.S. corporations to Puerto Rico was eliminated by the U.S. Congress, and it was phased out during the period 1996 to 2006. So what we are seeing now, really, is the kind of impact of that phase-out as companies have stopped investing, have closed shop, and have left the island. Just to give you a sense of how catastrophic this has been, manufacturing employment from its peak in 1997 to 2012, which are the last figures I have, has dropped by 48.9%. So basically, one out of every two manufacturing jobs have disappeared from the economy of Puerto Rico. I think in any society, that's a catastrophic fall.
And how much of that decline is attributable to the phasing out of the tax break?
Well, it's hard to determine how much is attributable to that. Some of it is attributable, can be attributed to that. Some of it can be attributed to the general global economic crisis that began in 2008, which undoubtedly aggravated the effects of the previous policy. But even before 1996, when the policy of tax exemption was, so to speak, in its best moment, even then, the unemployment rate in Puerto Rico was around more than 12-13% most of the time. So even then, even in its best moment, that mechanism of attracting foreign investment and relying almost exclusively on foreign investment for Puerto Rico's economic development was not able to generate any sort of organic or integrated economic development in the island, much less provide employment for the people who live in the island. So there are some aspects of the situation in Puerto Rico which have remained more or less constant over the last 50, 60 years that you have to take into account. One is, as I said, the reliance on the attraction of foreign investment. Another aspect of that is that much of the income that is generated in Puerto Rico leaves the island every year. The calculations are around $30 billion or $35 billion in profits and dividends that leave the island every year. And evidently, this is capital that is not reinvested in Puerto Rico, does not create employment in Puerto Rico, and does not pay taxes, most of it, in Puerto Rico. So you have a situation in which a few corporations generate tremendous profits in the island, and that those profits are not reinvested in the island. And the evident consequence, you know, the evident effect of that is that you have high levels of unemployment, high levels of poverty. But about 45% of the people in Puerto Rico live under the poverty level, which I guess the figure in the U.S. is between 15 and 20%, I don't remember exactly, but it's much higher in Puerto Rico than in the U.S. And the other aspect that flows from that is that thousands of people have to leave Puerto Rico every year because they simply cannot find employment. For the first time since we have been recording these figures, the population of Puerto Rico has decreased between 2000 and 2010. To a large extent because of the new mass migration of Puerto Ricans seeking jobs in the United States which they cannot find in Puerto Rico.
I would like to say, to add to what my colleague Rafael is saying, that, the economy of Puerto Rico is really quite exceptional if you look at places in the global south, in the sense that the disparity which between the gross domestic product, that is the income generated in the island, and the gross national product, which is the income that belongs to the residents of the island, is enormous. It's on the order of 35% of the gross domestic product. In other words, fully one-third of the income that gets declared in Puerto Rico by these corporations, and I'm saying declared because it's not all made here. There's some transfer that goes on that we can go into, but fully one-third of that leaves the island in the form of repatriated profits. And that is not normal. You know, if you look at these figures for elsewhere in the world, they gross domestic product and gross national product can be off from one another by something of 1, 2, 3%, not 35%. So it is an economy which had been used because of these tax exemption laws to declare profits here. Corporations use internal accounting mechanisms basically to shift income here, or located patents here so they could declare the profits here so they could shelter them from taxes. But in fact, none of that was trickling down to the local population. it was used, the enclave was used to make some profits, but also to shift income from subsidiaries of the same corporation in the United States to Puerto Rico, which could then be declared here and sheltered from profits.
This reminds me a bit of Ireland, strangely enough. I mean, using tax breaks to set up this kind of offshore enclave branch plant economy, but none of the benefits really trickle down to the population, and there's really no local sourcing, so there's no local economic development as a result of this inflow. It's just it's basically just a giant tax shelter.
If you look at the Puerto Rican economy over the years, over the last century, not to go further back, it has always been a very one-sided economy. That is, those sectors which U.S. capital has found interesting or attractive to invest in, those are the sectors that have been developed. And when U.S. capital decides, for whichever reason, that these sectors are no longer interesting, then they just disappear. During the first 30 years of the 20th century, Puerto Rico was a specialized in the production of sugar. It was a sugar monoculture. And then the sugar industry disappeared, and then we had a period of light manufacturing. And when those were not profitable anymore, those were eliminated. And then we had some petrochemical and pharmaceutical industries. And now those are being phased out. Underlying all of this is not really the existence. There's no real Puerto Rican economy. It's just the operations of U.S. corporations in Puerto Rican territory. And as I said, this has never been able to generate any sort of self-sustaining economic development in the island. To go back to the beginning of your question, the crisis that we've had, the manifestation of this crisis in recent years has been the fact that the combination of the economic slowdown and the policy of not collecting taxes from these major corporations implies that the government doesn't have money to operate. The only way it can do that is by borrowing, and it has been borrowing over the years. Now the public debt in Puerto Rico is about $70 billion, and the government now has to pay about $3.6 billion a year in order to service the debt. And as happens in many other countries, the government is unwilling to tax these corporations, is unwilling to attack the privileges of these corporations, and therefore the solution that they have for the fiscal crisis is attacking the pension funds of the workers, the firing public employees, reducing public services, charging more for public services, and so on. So the big debate in Puerto Rico right now is, how is this crisis of the state going to be paid for? Are the working people going to pay for that, or do we need some sort of economic measures or actions which go in the opposite directions, which begin to reorganize the Puerto Rican economy in a different way, and which, for example, place taxes on many of these very profitable operations that exist in Puerto Rico that right now do not contribute to the public finances. It's not different from some of the debates you're having in the U.S. about how to deal with the economic crisis and the crisis of the state.
No, it sounds like Detroit. How much autonomy does Puerto Rico have in determining its own tax policy? Can it tax as it wishes, or does it have to rely on Congress?
Well, on the Section 936, which is about federal taxes, that's entirely in the hands of Congress. These are federal taxes, and in fact, one issue with Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico has a very, I guess, exceptional status in that it is, to use the language of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1902, it belongs to, but it's not part of the United States, end of quote. It is a U.S. possession, and because of that, it has some very special economic characteristics which really are very telling when you think about, sort of the blind belief in market forces that being proposed to fix everything. Puerto Rico has had everything that the international financial agencies recommend to less developed countries for a century now. It has had free trade with the U.S. since 1901. It has had the U.S. dollar as a currency since 1898. It has had complete free mobility of capital in both directions, in and out of the economy. Its banking system is insured by the Federal Reserve of the United States. And it has something that no free trade agreement, of course, recommends to any developing country, but which is another special condition, which is it has perfect mobility of the labor force, in theory. In other words, Puerto Ricans can move to the United States freely since 1904 and have been U.S. citizens since 1917. That's a period of almost 100 years. And after 100 years of these theoretical, perfect free market conditions, the income in Puerto Rico is one-third of that of the United States.
How has that changed over time, that ratio to the mainland income?
It has been fairly constant ever since the Second World War. After the Second World War, there was a period in which the gap was somewhat closed. But after the 1970s, per capita income in Puerto Rico is about one-third of that of the United States, or even more telling, it's about one-half of that of the poorest states of the United States. And that hasn't shifted. It is a consequence in part of some of the things that we mentioned before. In Puerto Rico, we have right now we have around 15% unemployment rate. We have a 40% labor participation rate. That is, 60% of the people of working age in Puerto Rico are out of the labor market. They're not even looking for a job because they know they're not going to find one. So that is a tremendous pressure on wages. I mean, people in Puerto Rico are literally desperate to get a job, and it makes it very easy for employers to reduce wages. In the United States, minimum wage is a wage that is applies to a minority of the labor force. In Puerto Rico, most of the people who work either get the minimum wage or slightly above the minimum wage. So we're talking about a very low wage economy compared to the United States, and it has remained so over many years. And as Cesar says, there's no reason to think that a further application of free trade neoliberal policies are going to solve the problem, because this is what we have had for many decades. They are part of the problem,
now,
not part of the solution. What we think we need in Puerto Rico is a plan of economic reconstruction, which directed towards the development in Puerto Rico, productive activities, which are more, not exclusively, but more directed to the satisfaction of the needs of the internal Puerto Rican economy, that generate employment in Puerto Rico, that the income that is generated in these activities does not leave the island, but is reinvested in the island, as opposed to what happens now. We think it's in the interest of the people in the United States, not of the U.S. corporations who operate in Puerto Rico, but the people in the United States, because one of the ironies of the present situation is that while the U.S. private corporations extract from Puerto Rico billions of dollars in profits, the federal government has to send money to Puerto Rico to somehow mitigate the situation of poverty of the Puerto Rican people. So it's in the interest of the American people who pay taxes that Puerto Rico develops its own economy, which does not need subsidies from the outside in order to survive above the poverty level. The only people who would not be happy with Puerto Rico acquiring such an economy would be the corporations that now profit from the present situation, which, again, is neither good for the American working people nor good for the Puerto Rican working people. It's only to the benefit of a few very large corporations, most of which, by the way, are big pharmaceutical corporations.
That's the voice of Rafael Bernabe, a professor at the University of Puerto Rico. I'm speaking with him as well as Cesar Ayala of UCLA. Together, they're the authors of Puerto Rico in the American Century, published in 2009 by the University of North Carolina Press.
Well, let's go back a bit into Puerto Rican history. The U.S. got Puerto Rico as a spoil of the Spanish-American War in 1898, correct? And what's the legal status of that relationship been since?
The United States invaded Puerto Rico, as you said, in 1898 as a result of the Spanish-American War. There was a big debate at that moment on what to do with Puerto Rico and with the Philippines, which were also taken over at the time. And as Cesar pointed out, there were several options. You could make them into states of the United States. There was a big opposition to doing that. You could make them, let them be independent. And the option that was taken was to turn them into colonies. Now, the problem is that there's no place in the U.S. Constitution that allows for the existence of colonies. So they had to work their way around that, and the way they did that was to create a new status, which is what is called an unincorporated territory, which is that it is a territory of the United States, but it is not part of the United States. It's not incorporated into the United States. And what that means is that Congress, the U.S. Congress, can organize the government of Puerto Rico in whichever way it considers appropriate. Up until 1917, We had a governor named by the President of the United States, and one of the House of the Legislature was also named by the President. After that, you have a governor which was appointed by the President of the U.S., but the legislative chambers were elected by the people in Puerto Rico. Since 1948, the people in Puerto Rico can elect the governor of Puerto Rico. After 1952, that government operates under a constitution that was approved by the Puerto Rican people. But the fact is that to this day, Puerto Rico cannot determine its monetary policy. It doesn't have its foreign relations. All legislation approved by Congress, in which we do not have representation, all the legislation approved by Congress, unless indicated otherwise, applies to Puerto Rico.
Yes, I would like to add that the determination, as Rafael said, there was really no place envisioned for colonies in the U.S. Constitution. And until then, the territorial expansion of the United States to the western states had happened by first creating territories, and it was assumed that once a place became a territory, it would be on the path to statehood, and the people would be U.S. citizens and so forth. That is not what the U.S. Congress decided for Puerto Rico or the Supreme Court. And the 1902 decision, which is still, by the way, still holds, that declared Puerto Rico an unincorporated territory, a status which did not exist until then, was decided by basically the same court that had decided in 1996 the Plessy versus Ferguson case that segregation was legal in the United States.
Officially, Puerto Rico is called a free associated state with the United States. It is evidently a very, to put it kindly, a very asymmetrical relationship, and I would say it's very clearly a colonial situation. And as we said before, it's not only a political question, it's an economic question. We have an economy which is controlled by foreign corporations, which is the classic structure of a colonial economy, and some of the consequences of which are high unemployment, higher levels of poverty, non-integration of different economic sectors. It's in that sense not different from colonial situations that have existed in other places in the past. In the case of Puerto Rico, it's still the case in the 21st century.
Speaking of colonial situations, I assume there is some sort of comprador bourgeoisie that is the island's ruling class?
One of the distinctive features of Puerto Rico is really the absence of a significant bourgeoisie here. The word comprador bourgeoisie is a classic word, but it's not used much, but that is exactly what it is. The business sector here provides principally supporting services to U.S. Multinational corporations. And in fact, ironically, one of the reasons why there was a transition in Puerto Rico from the monoculture of sugarcane and plantations in the first half of the 20th century to industries in the second half of the 20th century was that people thought that U.S. corporations owned too much. In the 1930s, they talked about the excessive weight of absentee capital. Yet, at that time, about, I would say, 45 to 50% of the sugar crop was produced by U.S. corporations and about 45 to 50% by Puerto Rican corporations. It was about half and half, and there was at least a local sector to the economy. Nowadays, with the industrial structure, the bulk of Puerto Rico's exports are pharmaceuticals, and local capital has 0% participation in that. So, in fact, in the second half of the 20th century, you can say that foreign control and the strength of absentee capital was actually accentuated in Puerto Rico as opposed to diminished. And the situation right now is really one where there is no local business sector in the export industry. One report from the Economic Commission for Latin America of the United Nations put it eloquently. It says Puerto Rico is a great exporting economy, but Puerto Ricans are not exporters. In other words, it's U.S. capital producing here that exports, but not the local sector. So it is a comprador bourgeoisie, to put it.
Another example that one can give of that is that between 1976 and 1996, which is the epoch in which this mechanism of accepting federal tax exemption, that U.S. corporations operating in Puerto Rico didn't have to pay federal taxes, nor did they have to pay local taxes, so they basically paid no taxes. During that period, there was a disposition of the legislation which, in order for the corporations not to have to pay federal taxes, they had to leave, they had to place their capital in banks in Puerto Rico for a certain period of time. So over those 20 years, at any particular moment, there were about $10 billion in capital placed in banks in Puerto Rico. And the purpose of that was for that capital to be available for the development of the Puerto Rican economy. So banks could loan, banks could promote certain economic activities and have some sort of economic development locally as a result of the operations of the large U.S. corporations in Puerto Rico. Well, that capital was there during 20 years, and as you pointed out, the Puerto Rican bourgeoisie or the Puerto Rican capitalist class or the Puerto Rican entrepreneurs, whatever you want to call them, had all this capital, and they did nothing with it. They built unnecessary housing projects. They speculated in Wall Street with this money, and so on and so forth, but they had no vision of some sort of economic plan for Puerto Rico. So we have a local entrepreneur class, which has very, very little foresight. That's why we insist that it is the labor movement, working people who have to organize themselves, and through the government, through the state, through public initiatives, begin to reconstruct the Puerto Rico in a different direction. This is not entirely a new idea. During the Great Depression in the 1930s, through federal initiatives and local initiatives, institutions such as one which was called the Puerto Rico Reconstruction Administration were created in the midst of the last Great Depression to begin to reorganize the Puerto Rican economy, to begin to industrialize it, to begin to create public services, to distribute land, to diversify the agricultural production away from simply producing sugar, and so on. So we need something in that nature in the present. If you want to call it, you know, a more radical New Deal or something of that nature, as was tried in the 1930s. But unfortunately, the present government in Puerto Rico persists in seeking solutions which go in the opposite direction.
We're just about out of time, but that sort of program that you speak of, can that be done under the current Commonwealth relationship, or does some major overhaul of the U.S.-Puerto Rico relationship have to be a prerequisite to that happening?
Well, I think there are two questions there. Whether it can be done, I personally think it cannot be done. I think it will require some redefinition because, for example, if you want to protect the development of a Puerto Rican agriculture, which is a key thing we have to do, we now import about 85% of our food, which is ecologically and health-wise and commercially absurd. In order to do that, you need to be able to establish certain protections for Puerto Rican agricultural production, just to give you one example, and that will require redefining our relationship with the United States. But that doesn't mean that we cannot do anything within the present relationship, and I think we have to build a movement in Puerto Rico which proposes all sorts of economic changes that we need, and as we go along, we will be faced with the need to question many aspects of the present relationship with the United States. But I don't think we can... I think, in other words, I'm saying we have to come to the question of the need to change the relationship with the United States, but we don't have to start with that. We can start by proposing many immediate measures that can be taken in order to begin to reconstruct the Puerto Rican economy as it is right now.
Well, I'd like to address the federal aspect of this, which I think I'm not hopeful either, like my colleague Rafael, in the sense that I think the administrations in the United States right now, even the Obama administration, are a different kind of Democrat, represent a different kind of Democratic Party than the party of Roosevelt in the 30s or even the party of Lyndon B. Johnson. The party of Roosevelt and the party of Johnson were willing to have the state intervene directly in the economy and have the federal government do something. I have a sense that the new Democrats are willing to only give incentives to private capital so that maybe private capital can do something. It's a different kind of mentality. And I think what we need is, in some way, as Bernard said, some kind of reenactment of a new deal where the federal government says, you know, there has been market failure. The market hasn't done the job. So we have to step in to make up for market failure. And I would like to see more of that in the United States,
yeah,
unfortunately.
Yeah. What I will have to add, I'm sure Cesar agrees with me, is that Roosevelt was willing to do the things that he did, and Johnson, because there were mass movements in the streets pushing them in that direction. I mean, there was the rise of the CIO, there was the mass protest of farmers in the United States in the 1930s, there was the civil rights movement, there were all sorts of people in the streets in the 1960s, and this is what forced the Democrats or whoever was in power to enact significant reforms. And I think that's what, you know, evidently missing in the U.S. and in part in Puerto Rico too. And I think that progressives in Puerto Rico who want to reconstruct the Puerto Rico economy and progressives in the United States who are, you know, more aware than we are of the attacks on working people in the U.S. and want to build an alternative, we have to work together in terms of trying to change things in the island and changing things in the mainland. And it's a big job, but there's no option but, you know, trying to take it on.
Those were Cesar Ayala and Rafael Bernabe, authors of Puerto Rico in the American Century, published in 2009 by the University of North Carolina Press, speaking from San Juan. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Mercenaries by John Cale. Till next week, bye.
Mercenaries are useless, disunited, unfaithful. They have nothing more to keep them in a battle other than a meager wage, which is just about enough to make them want to kill for you, but not enough to make them want to die for you. Others.